From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
On Saturday, July 3rd, we got a report of some tar balls over on Crystal Beach, and we went over to investigate. We sent those off to be tested, and the results of that test came back positive as a match to the Deepwater Horizon event.
Tar balls hit Texas as the BP oil disaster enters its 77th day. We'll talk to a scientist who works with the government on the BP spill. He says BP is restricting his access to study the gushing well. Then, green jobs now and get to work. Those were the messages on the banners unfurled in the Hart Senate office building. We'll speak with the environmentalist responsible. He's being sentenced today and faces up to 3 years in prison. Then, the ACLU files a lawsuit against the U.S. government challenging the no-fly list. We'll talk to one of the plaintiffs, Adama Ba. She's lived in the U.S. since she was 2 years old. She got political asylum from Guinea to prevent her from undergoing female genital mutilation. But now she can't board a plane in this country. And Promised Land, a new film on the struggle for land in South Africa.
White farmers, all that they want is to make profits. While we don't have anywhere to live, we want our land back, and we want it now.
We'll speak with filmmaker Yoruba Richen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Oil from the BP Deepwater Horizon spills reached Texas for the first time more than 75 days after the oil spill began. Tar balls were spotted Monday at a pair of Texas beaches nearly 500 miles of coastline in the Gulf of Mexico from Texas to Florida have now been contaminated, spreading. Tar balls and oil sheen have also been spotted in Louisiana's Lake Pontchartrain, the large body of water north of New Orleans that's connected to the Gulf of Mexico. Meanwhile, more evidence has emerged showing federal regulators failed to grasp the dangers of offshore oil drilling. A September 2007 memo from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said large oil spills from proposed Gulf drilling projects are, quote, low-probability events. The memo also said an oil spill wouldn't likely affect brown pelicans, sea turtles, and other animals with Gulf Coast habitats. In other oil spill news, the Washington Post reports the Pentagon is continuing to use BP as a major supplier of military fuel. The annual value of BP's contracts with the Pentagon stand at nearly $1 billion. In fiscal 2009, BP was the Pentagon's largest single supplier of fuel. The Israeli government's partially eased the blockade on Gaza just ahead of today's visit by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House to meet with President Obama. Billed as a kiss-and-make-up session, the meeting marks the first time the leaders have met since Israel's deadly raid on a Gaza-bound aid ship in May. Under Israel's new rules, most consumer goods will now be allowed into Gaza, but construction equipment is still barred. In addition, the sea blockade will continue, and Palestinians will still be barred from exporting anything from Gaza. UN Mideast Envoy Robert Seri praised the slight easing of the blockade.
Well, of course, this is something we have been looking forward to for a very long time. I don't know how many times I've been telling the Security Council that the situation in Gaza is unsustainable and that the blockade was unacceptable and also politically wrong-headed. So a decision now by the Israeli government to substantially ease the closure regime can only be welcomed by me. Of course, we have to see it and also happen on the ground.
Hamas spokesperson Sami Abu Zuhri said the people of Gaza will remain under siege until the blockade is completely ended.
We demand that Obama put real pressure on Netanyahu to lift the siege on Gaza and to stop demanding simply for allowing more goods into Gaza, because this does not change anything but rather cements the policy of the siege.
Part of President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu's meeting will focus on Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. A new report from the Israeli group B'Tselem says Jewish settlements now control more than 42% of the West Bank. The group said the actual buildings of the settlements cover just 1% of the West Bank's land area, but their jurisdiction and regional councils extend to more than 42% of the area. Much of the land controlled by the settlements was seized from Palestinians. Meanwhile, an investigation by the New York Times has found that the U.S. Treasury Department is helping sustain Israel's illegal settlements in the West Bank by granting tax breaks on donations to support them. Over the past decade, at least 40 American nonprofit groups have distributed more than $200 million in tax-deductible gifts to help expand the settlements. The Times reports the tax-deductible gifts go mostly to schools, synagogues, and recreation centers, but it is also paid for guard dogs, bulletproof vests, and rifle scopes for settlers. The Justice Department's expected to file a lawsuit as early as today against Arizona over the state's new anti-immigrant law. The main argument of the suit will be the legal doctrine of preemption, which is based on the Constitution's Supremacy Clause and says that federal law trumps state statutes. The Arizona law requires police officers stop and interrogate anyone they suspect is an undocumented immigrant. In political news, Republican National Committee Chair Michael Steele is facing calls to resign after saying that Afghanistan is a war of Obama's choosing, despite the fact that it began years before the president took office. Republican commentators William Kristol and Liz Cheney have called on him to resign. Senator John McCain said Steele is going to have to assess as to whether he can still lead the Republican Party. Kentucky Republican senatorial candidate Rand Paul defended Steele, saying, quote, he is absolutely right. Afghanistan is now Obama's war. During the 2008 campaign, Obama was out in front and insisting that more troops be sent to Afghanistan. Obama called for expanding the war, even as he pretended to be a peace candidate, Paul said. In Costa Rica, opposition lawmakers are criticizing the government's decision to allow as many as 46 U.S. warships and 7,000 Marines into Costa Rican waters. For years, Costa Rica has given the U.S. Coast Guard access, but under a new agreement, U.S. warships, helicopters, and combat submarines would also be given access to help fight the so-called war on drugs. Syria has sentenced the prominent human rights attorney Haitham al-Malla to 3 years in jail. The 78-year-old attorney was jailed over comments he made on television criticizing the lack of democracy in Syria and the excessive powers wielded by security officials. Amnesty International condemned the sentence. President Obama's announced the awarding of $1.85 billion in loan guarantees to two solar power companies. Part of the money will go to the Spanish corporation Abengoa Sola for construction of a large solar plant in Arizona.
Once completed, this plant will be the first large-scale solar plant in the U.S. to actually store the energy it generates for later use, even at night. And it will generate enough clean, renewable energy to power 70,000 homes.
Greenpeace has accused one of the world's largest pulp, paper, and palm oil companies of destroying Indonesian rainforests and threatening Indonesia's efforts to address climate change. A new Greenpeace report focuses on the company Asia Pulp and Paper, a subsidiary of the Indonesian conglomerate Sinar Mas. Greenpeace also accuses Walmart, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Hewlett-Packard of sourcing products tied to the destruction of the Indonesian rainforest. In India, questions remain over the death of a top Maoist leader who died Friday alongside a freelance journalist who was interviewing him. Indian officials say Cherukuri Majkumar died in a gun battle, but supporters of the Maoist leader, who is commonly known as Azad, said he died in police custody. Puerto Rico has launched a probe of last week's violent clash between police and student demonstrators at the Capitol in San Juan. Student organizers say over two dozen protesters were treated for injuries after officers used batons, physical force, and pepper spray to block a large group of protesters from attending a legislative session on the state budget. In other news from Puerto Rico, Juan Manuel Garcia Paslacua has died at the age of 73. He was a well-known Puerto Rican attorney, political analyst, and historian. After his death on Friday, Puerto Rican Governor Luis Fortuno declared 3 days of mourning. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see, read, hear our interviews with Paslacua. And thousands of people are in Beirut today, attending the funeral of Lebanon's most eminent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah. He died on Sunday at the age of 74. In the 50s, he helped found the Dawa Party, the party of Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. He later served as spiritual mentor to Hezbollah. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's day 77 of the BP oil spill, and there is still no clear end in sight for the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. Up to 130 million gallons of oil have spilled into the Gulf of Mexico, with tens of thousands of barrels continuing to gush out of the Deepwater Horizon well every day. On Monday, tar balls were found on a beach in Texas, the first evidence that the spill has reached all the Gulf states, spanning 500 miles of coastline through Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and the Florida Panhandle. Meanwhile, cleanup efforts are far behind where they should be. In the 2.5 months since the disaster, BP has skimmed or burned just 60% of the amount of oil it promised regulators it could remove in a single day. That's right. The Washington Post reports that in March, just a few weeks before the disaster, BP filed a report saying it had the capacity to skim and remove more than 490,000 barrels of oil each day in the event of a major spill. The report was not questioned by federal officials. As of Monday, skimming operations have averaged less than 900 barrels a day. And as the disaster continues to worsen, new restrictions are being placed on the media. The Coast Guard has announced new rules keeping the public, including photographers and reporters covering the spill, from coming within 65 feet of any response vessels or booms on the water or on beaches. Violators could face a fine of up to $40,000 and felony charges. In order to get within the 65-foot limit, media must get direct permission from the Coast Guard captain of the Port of New Orleans. Well, we're joined now by a scientist leading a team of researchers trying to get access to the well to better study what's happening at the site. Congressman Ed Markey wrote a letter to BP last month requesting the corporation provide safe access to the well site and full financial support, but there's been no response from BP. Dr. Ira Leifer is the scientist leading the proposed research mission known as Deep Spill 2. He's also on the federally appointed Flow Rate Technical Group. He's a researcher in the Marine Science Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara, joining us now on the phone. Dr. Leifer, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what you are requesting and what you are not getting.
Well, Amy, about 10 years ago, almost to the day, there was an experiment in frigid Arctic Norwegian waters to try to learn where the oil would go. And because it was a small release, it was artificial, we didn't learn from that what we need to know now to try to understand where the oil's going from the Macondo spill. We don't know. We're searching in the dark. Deep Spill 2, this experiment that I proposed and created and brought together a team of scientists to research, is trying to understand hypothesis-driven science where the oil goes in the water column so that we can actually go and respond to it. And in part, it's for now to try to know what its effect on the ecosystem is. But a big part of this is for the future and for the next generation so that in a future oil spill, we actually are not searching blindly for where the oil goes, but we have a good idea and we can actually respond to it appropriately.
What has BP said?
It's been silence. I mean, we put together this experiment. We have literally centuries of field experience from world-class researchers like Miriam Kastner and Rick Coffin and Vern Asper, and we've heard nothing from BP, as well as other scientists I know who are doing and trying to do research, find themselves blocked at every turn from actually learning what we need to know so that we can address this spill safely.
What is your sense of how much oil is flowing out of this well?
I mean, the flow rate team is going to come up with its numbers within, I think, later this week, and they'll be sort of mine 10 towards the top side. But the real problem is not what the amount of oil is flowing out, but where it's going, what parts of the ecosystem it's attacking. I mean, it's like a cancer that is metastasizing. The patient, the ecosystem, may not be dead yet, but is at great risk. And patients sometimes die of pneumonia. In this case, a hurricane could come through. And my big worry is that if we don't know where the oil is going and where it's going to be, then this interwoven network and fabric that is the life in the Gulf of Mexico could be taken out. I mean, if, for example, is eagles that never get oiled, if their fish disappear, they too will die. And we really need to understand what's happening. And the science is not being done because, in my view and that of many of my colleagues, BP is blocking it.
Why do you have to ask BP for permission? Who is in charge here? You're working for the government. You're working with them.
As far as I understand, BP is still in charge of access to the well site, and as well as it's unclear in terms of financing and support for science to understand what happens. BP caused this accident, and so there's a certain strong sense that they should, in fact, support efforts to try to understand it, to minimize the damage. And instead, they seem to be worrying about their long-term profits and not the long-term health of the environment.
You're not getting permission to do this study, but this is, it seems to me, is an indictment not only of BP, but of the U.S. government that allows this to go on. But also reporters, journalists, photographers who are attempting to document this will now be charged with felonies if they come within 65 feet of any site. I mean, even to try to photograph an oiled bird?
I don't really understand that. It makes no sense to me. Where there's clear safety issues, of course, there's some issue. But here in Santa Barbara, we have oil, and people work around it and photograph it and so on. As a scientist, my concern is that if we do science, everyone wins. But if we don't, we're actually doing a disservice to humanity. And that's just inexcusable, in that if we don't do the science, then nobody learns from this horrible catastrophe to try to be ready for the future one. And to myself, that's inexcusable. So I and my scientific colleagues are trying to do everything we can to make sure that we learn as much about that. And I would include that the free and fair flow of information, reporters having access, is part of the learning process as a society, so that when there are accidents in the future, we actually can respond intelligently and not with a lot of unknown assumptions and just waving our arms and trying to hope we get things right.
Okay, so BP doesn't want you to study them, but how high up have you gone in the U.S. government since you work with the U.S. government to demand access?
What I've done is I've put together this experiment, and I've shared it with members of the technical flow rate team and other people within the government to hoping to get the go-ahead on being able to do this experiment. As a scientist, I can only make proposals for what to do and try to share what our efforts are with the public through venues like Democracy Now!
Dr. Lyford, do you think offshore drilling should end?
In the ideal world, I would tend in that direction. But my worry is that we import our oil, and if we stop producing it within the U.S., more of it will come from Nigeria, where no one cleans up any mess or accidents and activists get shot. So what I don't support is passing on our inability to effectively regulate safely offshore exploration onto the developing world, which just doesn't have the resources, the legal structure to deal with it. I think what we need to do is look towards places like Northern Europe, Norway, where they have a much more successful effort of controlling and making sure industry explores and exploits oil safely, and look in that direction. And the bottom line is, I think we use the oil, and we need to make sure that we produce all of our oil safely and not pass it on to the developing world.
I wanted to ask you about this report that has just come out, the cleanup efforts far beyond behind where they should be. BP skimmed or burned just 60% of the amount of oil it promised regulators it could remove in a single day. Again, the Washington Post reporting that in March, just a few weeks before the disaster, BP filed a report saying it had the capacity to skim and remove more than 490,000 barrels of oil each day in the event of a major spill. The report was not questioned by federal officials. As of Monday, skimming operations have averaged less than 900 barrels a day.
What I think we see here is clear evidence of how the investment in safety has not been made over the last decades. The state-of-the-art skimming vessels are not available. They're insufficient. There's not been a continuous upgrade of capabilities to retrieve oil. And so what the report is highlighting is wishful thinking rather than long-term investment strategies. Again, I've collaborated with scientists in Norway where there is much more government support for this kind of research. And there's a continuous program to ensure that the oil companies have the latest technology available, effective containment systems that can be deployed, and so on, in order to respond to an oil spill. And instead, it seems to be have been left to industry over the last decades. And industry has maximized their profits and not kept up with investing in case of an accident.
President Clinton and others have talked about bombing the well. What do you think of this, Dr. Leifer?
I think under certain circumstances and certain cases, this might be a good idea. But in this particular case, we don't know. The science has not been done. And I'm very worried, very concerned, almost frightened, you might say, that such a plan, bombing the well, would fracture the seabed and allow what is an engineering problem, oil coming from a single point, to convert into a natural system where the oil comes through thousands and millions of pathways right through the seabed into the ocean. In that case, the billions of barrels in this reservoir would vent and nothing would stop them into the ocean. It could vent like it's doing for decades. And instead of beaches, we'd have pavement. And I think the risk is extremely high. And the only way to know if it makes any sense is actually to do the science, to understand what's happening. And that science has clearly not been done. And so, therefore, I couldn't recommend in any conscience that that would be a good approach.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Ira Leifer, scientist in the government-appointed Flow Rate Technical Group and researcher in the Marine Science Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We will link to their letter asking BP to be able to study the well site. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, Mercy, Mercy Me by Marvin Gaye. Well, the environmentalist Ted Glick will be sentenced today and faces up to 3 years in jail for hanging two banners in a government building last year. Last September, the day the Senate returned from summer recess, Ted Glick and over two dozen other peaceful demonstrators unfurled two banners saying, "Green jobs now and get to work," inside the Hart Senate office building on Capitol Hill. They say they were trying to pressure the Senate to pass climate change legislation that had already passed the House. Glick was convicted in May of two misdemeanors: displaying a banner in a federal building and disorderly conduct, each of which carries a six-month jail sentence. But the U.S. Attorney's Office has asked the judge to triple Glick's sentence because of his two previous convictions, both of which also related to nonviolent protests. Ted Glick is 60 years old. He's been arrested 16 times, spent time in prison in 1971 for resisting the draft. He's the policy director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network and joins us now from Washington, D.C., just a few hours before he's sentenced for taking part in this protest, the banner hangs. Ted Glick, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain your motivation for what you did.
Well, thanks, Amy. I appreciate this opportunity. I have been active since 2003. On the issue of the climate crisis, I do believe that it is the overarching issue of our time and that we have to take this very seriously. This action was, quite frankly, not a major commitment of mine. I had other projects I was working on in my capacity as the policy director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, but I certainly supported this as my organization worked with others to make it happen. I believe that it was important to send a message to the Senate when they came back last September that it was on their plate now. They needed to step up to the plate and get serious about passing strong climate legislation, actually better legislation than what the House passed. The House passed bill was not that good. It was problematic in many ways. So I agreed to help to drop these two banners from the seventh floor of the Hart Senate office building. I knew there was a risk involved, a risk of arrest. I actually did not expect that if the police saw us dropping these banners, that I would be arrested. I've had some experience in the same building with a banner hang back during the first week of the invasion of Iraq. And at that point, the police told us to pull up the banners, and they escorted us out of the building. But that isn't what happened in this case. The bottom line is that people, in whatever ways they are moved to do so, have to take action on this issue. And now is, quite frankly, a really good time to do it, given that the Senate, 10 months after this action that we took, is finally getting to the issue of the climate crisis and our energy policy, linking it to what's going to be done about the BP blowout disaster as far as legislation governing, regulating deep water drilling in particular. So we need actions. This was one of a number of actions that I've undertaken. What's going to happen today, I don't know. We've had lots of letters that have been sent to the judge. We estimate probably 250 letters that have gone into the judge.
Ted Glick,
there'll be people in the courtroom.
I just wanted to clarify, since we just have a minute. I mean, you are now facing 3 years in prison. We just had a conversation about the BP oil spill. It's entered its 77th day. The heads of BP certainly have not been indicted, though there is a criminal investigation into them. It's not clear exactly what that means in terms of holding them personally responsible. This is the worst environmental catastrophe in U.S. history. Massey, West Virginia, the head of Massey Energy, the coal company that whose explosion led to the deaths of 29 workers in the Gulf, it was 11 workers, has not been indicted. How do they justify you facing 3 years in prison for a banner hang saying green jobs now?
You'd have to ask the U.S. Attorney's Office why they are prosecuting this case like this and why they have made it very clear that they have the right to triple the maximum sentence because of these past convictions and to ask for 3 years in jail. Why they are wasting time, energy, and resources on this, I don't know.
And finally, the issue of the time being now with the BP oil explosion and the legislation in the Senate. You did this before the Copenhagen conference that led to a failure. What do you want to happen right now? You have 30 seconds.
Well, people need to put pressure on the Senate. You know, there should be the Senate should be flooded right now. They come back from their recess next week. They should be flooded in this month of July with demands that they get serious about the climate crisis, which they're not yet being serious about. Same with President Obama. President Obama needs to give leadership on this right now, the kind of solutions that are going to do the job. That's what we need. And they need to hear from us. We need a grassroots uprising demanding action on climate change right now, this month,
by the Senate. Thank you very much for being with us. Policy director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network faces 3 years in jail for the banner hang last September. Two banners, Green Jobs Now, the other one saying, get to work. They hung them inside the U.S. Hart office building, the Senate office building. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we go now to the government's no-fly list, which reports indicate has roughly doubled to 8,000 names since the failed bombing attempt on a Detroit-bound flight last Christmas. People on the list can't fly to or from the United States or over U.S. airspace. Well, the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, has filed a lawsuit against top Justice Department and FBI officials on behalf of 10 Americans and legal residents on the government's no-fly list. Five of them remain stranded overseas. Three are veterans. Not one of the 10 people named in the lawsuit has been given any information about why they're on the list or a chance to clear their names. I'm joined here in New York by two people. Adama Ba is one of the plaintiffs in the case. She's 22 years old. She's a citizen of Guinea and was granted political asylum here in the United States, where she has lived since she was 2 years old. She fought against being sent back to Guinea, where she faced female genital mutilation. She found out she was on the list last year when she was trying to fly to El Paso. We're also joined by Ben Wisner, staff attorney with the ACLU National Security Project. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Ben, start off by saying what you found and who these 10 people are.
Well, as you said, the list has expanded dramatically since the 25th of December, since that failed attack in Detroit. And although the government tells newspapers that the list is 8,000, we have to understand that the impact of that is vastly magnified, because that includes the 8,000 individuals on the list and the many, many, many thousands more who have names that are similar to those people. So I think that saying that it's 8,000, even though the number is way too large, probably understates the problem. We at the ACLU have been contacted by so many people who find themselves in this situation. They show up at an airport. They are denied boarding. The government will not confirm or deny that they're on a list, will not give them any reason for why they can't board, will not show them any evidence for why they can't get on these flights. The only recourse that someone like Adama has is to go to a government website, to put in her name, and hope that some bureaucrat somewhere will correct a mistake or maybe change his mind about the situation. As you said, some of our plaintiffs are American citizens who are stuck overseas, who have been placed literally into exile by their government by virtue of a secret government blacklist.
And the 10 people you're representing, the veterans?
Three of the plaintiffs of these 10 are veterans of the Army, Air Force, and Marines, who now find themselves in this situation. I think there's been this general freakout in the government since December 25th, and the attitude must be, dump them all on the list. We'll sort it out later. We can't let anybody get through who might conceivably present a threat. But remember, even if you're charged with a serious crime in this country, you're told what the charges are. You're given a lawyer. You're given a chance to object and defend yourself. These people have absolutely no legal recourse whatsoever.
Adama Ba, explain what happened to you.
Well, the first thing that happened is I went to check in, and they said, see a ticket agent. So I stepped up to a ticket agent. And immediately, they got on the phone. They called security. So many people came, but nobody told me why I was on the list or how to get off the list.
Which airport did you go to?
LaGuardia Airport.
LaGuardia?
Yes.
And what exactly happened when you went there?
When I went there, I just went to the ticket agent, showed her my ID. She typed in my name and just got on the phone. And from there on, TSA was coming in, federal agents, Homeland Security. But nobody's telling me what's going on. Why am I on a list?
Well, Adama took out her cell phone and called me because I had been helping her with another matter. I jumped into a taxi and said to her, don't speak to anyone until I get there. When I arrived at the airport, we got there just before an FBI agent and a member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force arrived. We all went into a private room where a really extraordinary scene unfolded. Even with a lawyer at her side, they would give her no information. Instead of telling her why she was on a no-fly list, they asked her why she thought she was on a no-fly list. They asked her to give names of people who she was associated with, who they might be interested in speaking to. And I said, Absolutely not. She will answer questions if you have specific questions. But this is a fishing expedition for incriminating information about other people. This is not how it's going to work. And I just wonder what happens in those rooms when there isn't an ACLU lawyer sitting next to the person on the list.
Adama, many people may remember your story and not remember it's you, the person who's speaking here today. But explain what happened to you, how you got political asylum in the United States.
Well, I came to this country when I was 2 years old with my mother. And when I was 16, I was detained for immigration reasons. I didn't know I was illegal, so that's when I found out. After 3 years of battling, I got an asylum in 2007. I wore an ankle bracelet for 3.5 years.
Wait, explain why you got the political asylum, what it was you faced.
Well, I got the political asylum because in my country, they circumcise women, so.
And you were afraid if you went back,
yes,
this would happen to you, as it did to all the women members of your
family?
All
the women in my family have gotten done, even my mother.
Why did you wear an ankle bracelet?
They wanted to track my immigration. I don't know.
And so you wore that for. Now, going back to an article in 2006, Young Woman Fears Deportation and Mutilation from the New York Times by Nina Bernstein. Adama Ba's schoolmates were jubilant when she returned to 10th grade at Heritage High School in Manhattan in May 2005 after 6 weeks in a distant juvenile detention center. Her release put to rest the federal government's unexplained assertion that Adama, a popular 16-year-old who wore jeans under her Islamic garb, was a potential suicide bomber. But a year and a half later, with many of her friends planning proms and applying to college, Ms. Ba, now 18, this was a few years ago, was still wearing an electronic ankle bracelet and tethered to a 10 p.m. government curfew, restrictions that were conditions of her release. This is when you were still facing deportation.
Yes.
But today, you're 22 years old. Why were you going to El Paso?
I was just going to travel to take a vacation. It was 3 years on ankle bracelet. My ankle bracelet was taken off. I just wanted to take a vacation.
Did you think you were off this list?
The thing is that I flew before to Florida, so I didn't think I would be on a list. So when I went to travel to El Paso, that's how I found out.
Ben Wisner, how do people find out they're on the list unless they go to the airport? And what are the ways you can get off the list?
Well, you can't find out unless you try to fly, because there's no government source of information that will confirm or deny. I suppose you could try to be clever and buy a fully refundable ticket and see if you're able to print out a boarding pass at home. But that's really the only way that you could find out, because the government does not give you any information about this. You can go to a government website on the Department of Homeland Security's website, which purports to provide redress. But all it does is collect information from you. You can describe the incident. You can give your identifying information. And then you have to hope that someone somewhere else will look at that information and change their mind. But the Department of Homeland Security, which runs that website, doesn't even have the authority to take you off the list. That authority resides in the FBI, which doesn't interact with the public. I mean, this basically is a Kafka-esque program that really doesn't give you any reasonable way to rebut the evidence or, in many cases, innuendo against you.
Can you talk about the American citizen who's being prevented from coming into this country from Egypt?
Well, and we have several, but this man, Ayman Latif, who is a veteran of the U.S. Armed Forces, who worked for the Postal Service, was in government employ for 15 years, is living in Egypt with his family. He needed to return to Florida for a veteran's disability evaluation so that his benefits wouldn't be cut by several hundreds of dollars. This is a disabled U.S. Marine. He tried to fly back. He was not allowed to board the flight. He wasn't given any information about it. He's been waiting for months. FBI agents have flown to Egypt from Florida to interview him. He's answered every question. He took a polygraph exam, which he said that he passed. They still won't tell him why he's on the list. They still won't tell him what he needs to do to get off. This really is a deprivation of his citizenship. There's no legal basis for the U.S. government to keep a citizen abroad, and the government will confirm that. So they're using this no-fly list to accomplish something that is profoundly unconstitutional.
Can you talk about the Somali-American family whose son, Yahya Waheli, is also stranded in Cairo?
Well, and I should tell you, I don't represent Mr. Waheli, but he finds himself in exactly the same situation. This is a U.S. citizen who is in Egypt trying to get back to the United States, again, has answered every question that FBI agents have asked him. And it seems like what the FBI is doing with these Americans stuck abroad is that it's taking advantage of their situation to try to do what they did with Adama, to ask questions about anyone they might have met anywhere, just to cast the widest possible net and to get people to, in some cases, even try to be informants against others. The result is that we have U.S. citizens who are separated from their own country without any legal justification. Hmm.
And finally, Adama. So you're born in Guinea. You come here. You learn that you are not a citizen, actually, when you're a teenager. But in 2005, your father is deported, though there's such outcry over you, a popular teenager in high school at Heritage High, that they allow you to stay. You, though, can't finish high school because you have to support your family. You have
four. I actually did finish high school, but I still have to support my family.
And you have four brothers and sisters
yes,
here
I
and
do.
Your mom.
Yes, I do.
And so what do you plan to do now?
Well, I hope to get off the no-fly list and see what the future holds for me.
Well, we will leave it there, and we will certainly continue to follow this lawsuit. Adama Ba, citizen of Guinea, who applied and gained political asylum here in the United States, where she's lived since she was 2 years old. She is on the government's no-fly list, as thousands of people are. Ben Wisner, staff attorney in the ACLU's National Security Project. ACLU has just brought suit on behalf of 10 Americans and residents to challenge the no-fly list. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Blue and Green, Miles Davis here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. South Africa remains in the news during this final week of the World Cup, but behind the drama of the games and away from the spotlights of the soccer stadiums, there's another story unfolding about the reality of post-apartheid South Africa. It's been called the greatest challenge since the country's liberation. More than 15 years after the end of apartheid, the struggle over land remains a deeply divisive issue between blacks and whites. In 1994, the African National Congress-led post-apartheid government promised to redistribute a third of the land within 10 years, but the struggle for economic justice continues.
Over the last 10 years, less than 3% of agricultural land has been transferred to those who were dispossessed in the past. This is unsustainable, and it's a ticking time bomb.
You must get your land back.
We are the landowners. We must protect the value of our land.
Chalera!
Commercial white farmers. All that they want is to make profits. While we don't have anywhere to live, we want our land back and we want it now.
It's not about whites. It's not about blacks. It's about the very fact that we are landowners, that we own land, we have rights in terms of the Constitution.
I'm just scared that we're going to go the same route as the rest of Africa. They kick out the whites, then they take over and the country never comes right.
I don't want to say it's a reverse of the forceful removal, but he doesn't have choice.
There's not much that an individual can do in order to defend himself against institutions such as the government.
I'm a fifth generation South African. This is my home. Where am I going?
That's an excerpt of the trailer for the new film premiering tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern on PBS as part of the POV documentary series. The film is called Promised Land. It follows two legal struggles over land in contemporary South Africa. Last week, I spoke with the film's director, Yoruba Richen, a former Democracy Now! Producer, about the film.
I started the film about 6 years ago, and I began because I had recently read that the land issue was still an intractable problem. At that point, it was 10 years after the end of apartheid. And I began looking into it, and I found these stories of transformation that was trying to happen. The first person I found was Roger Roman, the character Roger Roman, the white farmer who goes through his own personal transformation and gives up half his land in an effort of racial reconciliation.
Let's go to Roger Roman right now.
In the 1994 election, one of the effects that it had on me was, I think for me, it created the opportunity to become an African. So I bought the farm as part of my process of getting to know my own country. After two or three years, I got a letter from the local white council, which, although we were already in the new South Africa, this council had remained as a hangover from the apartheid days. The council had been approached by about 30 of the white landowners in the area to get rid of all what they called black squatters, illegal squatters.
Coming out of the doorway there is Ntati Obed Moja, who is the man who's 103 years old.
I was born in this place.
In this house here, wasn't it, Ntati?
Yes, in that little house.
The fact that one man had been living here since his birth in 1901, how he becomes the squatter, and the whites who have purchased or stolen the land in the interim are not the squatters. It's a bit ironic.
That's Roger Roman. Tell us more about him.
Well, he is a fascinating person, very unusual in his recognition of the white privilege that he had had all his life in South Africa. And as the film shows, he is asked to, after he buys a piece of land, he's asked to kick the native black indigenous people that had been living on it, and he refused to do so, and really looked into himself and decided that he could no longer be a part of this system that, even though it was 1998 at that point, was still fostered this inequity. And he was, and he chose to do it, and then he became a land activist, and that's what he is now. And he has his organization, Land for Peace, really is trying to get the white landowners to not necessarily do what he did. What he did was maybe hard for a lot of people to do, but to be a part of the process of land reform.
How did you find Roger?
I found him, honestly, through reading and calling people before I left for my first shoot. And I got him on the phone. And as soon as I got him on the phone, I knew he was a very compelling character just from the phone conversation. And so he was one of the first people, if not the first person, that I met when I was down there. And he is the one who led me to the larger story that is depicted in the film.
Describe that story.
So the other story, there are two other land claims that I follow. One is the Makarang community outside of Johannesburg. And they have been trying to get—they put in a claim for their land, which they and their ancestors were removed. According to them, these removals started in the 60s and went all the way up until the 50s and went all the way up until the 80s. And they filed for this sometime in the late 90s, and the white community, the local white community, which is made up of about 300 farmers, decided to challenge them, and they don't believe that they have what they call a valid land claim. And so there's been this battle in this area, and it's still, in 2010, it's still, you know, it still goes on.
So you have the story of this land claim. Tell us the other.
The other story is the story of the Malamus. And the Malamus are a family, which is different than the Makarang. The Malamus are a family who are have actual proof that their grandfather, Abram Malamu, was an owner of the land. They have title deeds to the land. And there's much more documentation in their story about what happened to their family and how they were removed. And their family, they know that the documents show that their grandfather was compensated, actually. So he did receive some money for being forced off. And that is what is challenged by when they put in their claim. It's a piece of land that four white farmers currently own. Three of them eventually concede, and one stays to fight. And his name is Hans Visser. And Hans Visser has been on that land since the 1950s and 60s. His grandparents had it, and he has a business there, and he has his family there, and he believes that since the Malamus were compensated, that they weren't forced off the land.
So Yoruba, how does the community take him on?
So they file the claim. They, as I said, three of the farmers concede, and Visser decides that he's going to fight it. And he says that they've been compensated, and that the Malamus knew. He says they knew what they were doing. He knew what he was doing. So why should he give the land back? And eventually, what happens is they come to an impasse. Neither side gives up, and the government steps in. And it's the first farm expropriation in the country, and this was in 2007. And this was, at that point, you know, many years after the promises had been made to redistribute the land, and so little had happened, so little had been redistributed. And the government decided that they were, you know, going to take a stand in this case and take the land and give it back to the Malamus.
Let's go to the scene where Hans Visser is moving out and the family is there.
The promised land. We are there.
Hello, Clip himself.
You see, Abraham, and this is
the wife.
He died on the 9th of September, 1903. If the dead people see, he must be proud of us as well. Hmm.
I believe land reform is not an instrument in which to enrich people, but rather it should be an instrument which would make it possible for people to earn their own keep. It's senseless for people to inherit a property and they do not have the skills to operate the property.
Let's come and have a look at the scenery on the side. Yeah, man, this is beautiful, man.
Very beautiful.
I personally feel it hasn't been just. It's going to put me back quite a long ways. I won't have sufficient funds to buy another farm. I'm not a prophet, I can't prophesize, but it's only in the future that we will see whether this process is a successful process or is it a wrong process, where we're undoing wrongs in the past by repeating the wrongs in the future.
A scene from Promised Land, which is airing on POV. Yoruba Richen, why did you initially get interested in South Africa?
Well, I had had a long-standing interest in South Africa since I was a kid in the 80s. I followed the freedom struggle there. One of my first jobs in media was interning at South Africa Now, the program that was bringing news from South Africa during its state of emergency. And when Mandela was released, we walked from, you know, our home in Harlem to Yankee Stadium to see him with my whole neighborhood. And I think obviously for so many people, the freedom struggle was inspiring and was our struggle, you know, and especially for African Americans here in the U.S. So it was just a country that I'd always been fascinated by and wanted to go and follow the developments. And as I said, when I started seeing reports in 2003 about that the land issue that the whites still own, this was 10 years after the end of apartheid, owned the majority of the land, and that the inequity had, you know, barely shifted, I became very interested because we hadn't heard that. You know, we knew that the political struggle was won, but it's always the economic struggle, right, that is the challenge.
And is the ticking time bomb, really.
Exactly. And is the basis of so—and I also was interested in it because land is such the issue in so many countries, in so many post-colonial societies. That seems to be where this intractable problem lies.
And we can bring it right through to today. The World Cup is in South Africa. The world is looking at South Africa. But there's a part of South Africa they don't see.
Absolutely, absolutely. When they were building these stadiums for the Cup, which obviously is a huge honor for South Africa to have, and they're, you know, thrilled to have it in many ways. But the landless, the landless who live in the shanty towns, who don't have, you know, who don't have their own piece of land, who don't have houses, there were many removals that went on through the country to build these stadiums. And this time, the removals were of a black government, you know, to its people. So, again, it just showed that this problem still persists. This problem is at the basis of so many of the economic inequalities that are still there.
Let's go to a last scene from Yoruba Richen's film, Promised Land.
We are Africans. We don't say they are not Africans. We don't say whites are not Africans. But we must be seen running these countries. We must be seen developing this country. Mandela is old. Mandela did his work, sacrificing for 27 years in jail. He was there for us. So we can't expect the old man to do everything for us. He said, now, claim. And we have to make sure that we make his dream come true.
An excerpt of Promised Land by Yoruba Richen, and it's a great honor to have had you here in our new studios, Yoruba, since I really think of you as having helped build them, having been a part of the Democracy Now! Family.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy. It's great to be here.
Look forward to seeing this on POV. Promised Land airs on POV on PBS tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Yoruba Richen, former Democracy Now! Producer, is the filmmaker who made the film. And finally, Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua has died at the age of 73. He was a well-known Puerto Rican attorney, political analyst, historian. After his death on Friday, the Puerto Rican governor, Luis Fortuño, declared 3 days of mourning. Today, we go back to a conversation we had with Pasalacqua just after Sonia Sotomayor was made Supreme Court Justice.
My hair stands because I have been, as you know, attentive to the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States for years, 50 years to be exact, and I never expected that the diaspora would produce the first Hispanic Puerto Rican judge in the Supreme Court of the United States. What to me is the crucial element of what we are today celebrating is that for the first time the census issued last summer said that there were more Puerto Ricans in the United States than in Puerto Rico. Now, the diaspora has produced a Supreme Court judge of the United States of America. And now a bill has been filed in Congress by 90 members of the House of Representatives, finally solving the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States and providing the opportunity of rejecting colonialism in the ballot next year. So, again, I must confess that it is one of those days, in one of those years, in which the whole relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States is being transformed before our own eyes.
That was Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua. He died at the age of 73 on Friday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.